Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This episode of the Cult Popture Podcast was brought to you by our Patreon. If you want to tell us which films we should watch, get up to 2 extra exclusive podcasts a month, give us something to talk about in the post-credits scene at the end of each episode, or join us for our monthly Movie Club Zoom call where we discuss a film together, then please consider joining the cult and donating at www.patreon.com/cultpopture. Fuck, that was a good clip.
Very proud. Proud of my boy for his claps.
Welcome to Cult Popture, but more specifically, welcome to Film Franchise Fortnights, which is a show on the Cult Popture podcast. But you know this if you're listening to it. It means you found it. It means it wasn't too confusing. So take that, Richard and AJ, when we started the podcast and wondered if it would be too confusing.
Yeah. Do you know, we actually haven't been called the Cult Popture podcast for a couple of years now. It's just been Cult Popture on people's feeds.
Wow.
The thumbnails still say the podcast. We still call it the podcast. But it seemed like Cult Popture just needed to be the name of the podcast. And it is the Cult Popture podcast in the same way that the YouTube channel is the Cult Popture YouTube channel.
You know?
Is this interesting?
Yeah, I feel like you shouldn't have used Cult Popture for both examples. Like, you should have given a more widely known example, you know?
What's more widely known than Cult Popture? I don't understand.
All right. So today on Film Franchise Fortnights, we are talking about something very different from our usual kind of thing.
Because we've been, I don't know if I'm AJ and that's Richard, and we've been doing this Film Franchise Fortnite show on the Cult Popture podcast, Cult Popture, for over 5 years now. We're in our sixth season. And in that time, what it's always been is we take a film franchise, we watch all of them within a fortnight, and then we discuss it. And then almost in a way where it felt very close to our intellectual property being stolen, a film franchise came out in a fortnight. No one said it. No one said, this is a film franchise fortnight, but it was very suspicious. I think maybe they were scared of our lawyers.
Yeah, that's because... A fortnight is 2 weeks, and all the marketing said it's a trilogy released over 3 weeks, but the first and third film are 2 weeks apart. They probably didn't want to, you know. Interesting. So this is, we normally randomly choose, or it's Patreon selected. This was like, how can we not, you know? And so it's, the Fear Street trilogy on Netflix is what we're talking about. You might have seen them. You might have heard your friends talk about them. Go check them out. This is the way that they're done means that we kind of have to spoil all three off the bat. So it's not as easy to do like a segmented conversation where we don't talk. So if you're interested in them, just go watch all three and then come back here to chat. It's not going to be like, oh, I'll only listen to your discussion on part one because it's the only one I've seen. Just go watch them all. Okay. And then come back.
Okay.
Or if you don't give a shit, just keep listening because you don't need to watch the films.
I'll be back in 9 hours then.
9 hours.
That's how long, wouldn't that be? Two-hour movies?
Three six-hour movies.
That's 6 hours. Sorry.
Yeah, we didn't bloody watch. This isn't The Irishman.
I'm taking a 45-minute break in between each film.
It's 330 minutes, 5.5 hours.
Okay.
So, there you go.
It's not even 6 hours.
It's not. Even that would have been ridiculous of you to suggest. Okay, so Fear Street. So this is a trilogy of three films, all directed by Lee Janiak. So the films are Fear Street Part 1, 1994, Fear Street Part 2, 1978, and Fear Street Part 3, 1666. Is that all the movies in the franchise? Well, yes, but also kind of not. But we'll get to that. Fear Street... overall, what is the trilogy about?
So it's based on an R.L. Stein series.
Yeah.
A book series, the Goosebumps guy. His more like, I Mr. assume, Bumps. teen-oriented Mr. Bumps series. And it is about... Okay, I get a little foggy on the lore, especially by the end of the third one. I was like, I can't remember what the actual lore is. But in this town, there's this town called Shadyside, and they have like a Shelbyville to their Springfield called Sunnyvale. And everyone who lives in Sunnyvale is really happy. And everyone who lives in Shadyside is really miserable because over the last 300 years, there have been consistent, horrific murders that have taken place every few years, and it is believed that the murders are the result of a witch who was killed in 1666, cursing the town and making it so that if you like she every couple hundred years or however long she possesses someone and they go and kill a bunch of people. And the series broadly is about set in different, it takes three different examples of this idea from different time periods, 1994, 1978, and 1666, where it all began. And we see sort of different horror throwbacks.
Yeah, it's kind of like, it's sold as being like, each one is a throwback to a different era, a different genre of horror. So 94 is obviously influenced by the likes of Scream and I Know What You Did Last Summer. 1978 is, it's set in a camp, so it's very much Friday the 13th. And then 1666 is more your kind of fucking American Horror Story coven, whatever.
The Vavitch.
The Vavitch. Yeah. And the Vavillage.
And the Willage.
But yes, that's kind of the overall thing. If you think that sounds cool, go watch them. But what is part one about?
Okay, so it's 1994, and it starts with a very sort of Scream-inspired slaying of Maya Hawke, who works at a mall. Mm. And then it follows a group of teenagers who discover it's the same guy who killed Maya Hawke is back from the dead.
It was Maya Hawke's boyfriend or friend.
Flirty friend.
I think Wikipedia describes it as murder by her friend Ryan, who had previously shown no indication that he planned on killing her.
The worst, that's the ultimate betrayal.
You said you wouldn't.
And so it's sort of them facing off against this killer while also they're kind of on the run from the local sheriff. There's a bunch, it's Scooby-Doo 2 Monsters Unleashed style. A bunch of the previous serial killers from throughout time are like revived and all start going after them as well. And they basically work out it's because the main character's girlfriend, and she is a girl too, that's right everybody.
Each of these films has a twist that they like set up and I'm immediately like, yep. Boom. Like they go, oh, you need to get over Sam. I'm like, Sam will be a girl. And then cut to, and you see a shot of like her looking at a guy and a girl making out, and she's like, huh, and I'm like, yeah, I'll be the girl. And then it's like, got you, Sam's a girl.
None of the twists worked on me. And let's go through this with each movie. Yeah. That twist didn't work on me just because I guess I'm still like unconsciously like assuming that it's going to be a non-queer relationship, a heterosexual relationship. So that worked on me, I guess, though. I don't know how I feel about that being used as a twist. That feels a little... I don't know. But
well,
also,
it's done in a twist in the way that it's like, huh? Oh, did you think she... Oh, well, hey, that's on you. Yeah.
Interesting that you would assume my boss was a man.
Yeah. It's that kind of thing. It's like, oh, you just assumed, did you? It's like, well, no, I didn't. Yeah. Oh, well, yeah, then you're a bigot.
Yeah. And it's cool. I thought... I think, in my defense, it is set in the 90s when... like a lot less people were out of the closet as a teenager, yeah. I guess.
Wait, so you said none of the twists worked on you, but this one did. Is that what you're saying?
Sorry, no, you're right. I've said something wrong. None of we had you guessed all the twists. I don't know what the twist in the third one you're referring to. And the second one's the real Money Melon. That's where the funny thing happened. We'll get to that, though. But, yeah, so she spills, the girlfriend spills blood, her own blood, on the buried corpse of Seraphia, who is the witch that they didn't know was buried out in the woods. And so therefore all the monsters are after her because her blood has spilled on it. So they're attracted to her blood. Mm. So all the friends work out this plan eventually the plan is to kill Sam, who's the girlfriend, but revive her so that the curse will be broken, because they find out that a girl from 1978...
Wait a minute!
she did the same thing. She died and was revived, and that's how she allegedly defeated the curse. And so a bunch of the friends die, but they manage to revive Sam, only to find out later that they were wrong in their assumption. Sam stabs Dina, who's the main character, but Dina's fine for some reason. Yeah. They call up, they get in contact with the girl that survived from 1978 and tie up their now demonically possessed friend Sam and go.
While we wait for part two to come out.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, what'd you think of this film?
I think I'm going to break a lot of hearts here, Richard. I thought this was awful. I thought this was dog shit. This is such a bad movie. And it's one of those, am I taking crazy pills or is everyone else taking crazy pills? This has like a pretty high Rotten Tomatoes score.
What do you think it is?
Like 80, something like that.
83.
Everyone in the Discord is giving it like 4.5 stars, 4 stars on Letterboxd. This is the worst movie of 2021. I thought this sucked. I thought this was so bad, and I don't understand. I've been holding on to this. I mean, people have seen my rating, but everyone's like, you've seen Fear Street? It's pretty cool. I'm like, this was awful. I hated this movie. I thought it was so bad. And I've been dying to talk to you for 2 weeks.
So I really liked it when I watched it. And just as the 2 weeks have gone by, I've really soured on it.
God, my heart is warmed by that, Richard.
Like, it's one of those things.
I was so worried.
I still liked it. I would still say that it's a net positive. It's a 51%. It's the film above the Nymphomaniac Constant for me. And there's a few things about it that really, really rubbed me the wrong way. As time
I've got
went
a
on.
Few of them as well.
So, like, first off, I fucking love the idea of this series. Do not get me wrong.
And concept only, it's a great idea for a franchise. And as the franchise podcast, very interested in this idea of a horror franchise that's set in a different era. Like, how many times on the show, Richard, have we done a continue the franchise that's just been, it's the same thing, but it's a period piece. Yeah, I love that idea, and I love the premise of this franchise,
to do different genre pieces, essentially.
Fantastic idea.
And also the thing that, like, when I started the first one, 1994, I was like, wait a minute, this means that they never lift the curse, because this is the most recent one. And then there's a minute long, like, epilogue to the film that goes, come back next time. And I didn't like that so much, because it's like, I thought, oh yeah, this is actually like a fairly competent standalone horror. But then it just ends with a trailer for the second film, both figuratively and literally. It ends with like very much like a, you have to come back next time. And then it just plays the trailer for the second film. Okay, main points. Dina, which also I found the name Dina very distracting, because at work for the last like fucking 2 years, they've been talking about this program they're bringing in called Dina, and it's going to revolutionize the way we tell news. And I know that the Venn diagram of like people who will get that and be affected by that is like, of people who listen to the podcast and people I directly work with, is just Kate. And hi, Kate.
Hey, Kate. I was going to say, I'm not even in this Venn diagram.
Yeah. It's literally just Kate. So, hello, Kate. And I'm sure you'll message me when you hear this. But I wonder if you found that distracting as well. Anyway, Dina fucking sucks. The program that they're introducing sounds like it'll actually be quite good.
Sounds groundbreaking.
The character, the character of Tina, like she fucking sucks. She's one of those like, and I had this problem when I watched the Power Rangers movie.
I'm so glad you're bringing this up. I've never seen Power Rangers, but I've heard your Power Rangers analogy for years, and your Angus thongs and perfect snogging analogy for years. And watching this movie, I was like, how can Richard like this? This feels like a textbook example of the kind of character I've heard him talk about how much he hates. Continue.
She's like, so it's that kind of thing where like this character is horrible to everyone, and so, and I can't remember the exact details of the breakup. Do you remember that
she moves to Sunnyside?
Yeah,
Sunnyvale.
And it's like, but then like Dina's the bad guy in the breakup. For reference, Angus Thongs and Perfect Snogging has a character who's just horrible to everyone around her, and then they end up like not wanting to be friends with her anymore. And then you're supposed to feel sympathetic for her.
It's the whole thing of like, by virtue of them being the protagonist, you're supposed to be on their side.
And the Power Rangers film, the main female character, who's Jasmine in Aladdin,
Naomi
Scott. Her two friends who you're supposed to hate because they're stuck up bitches, the reason that they're not friends anymore is because Naomi Scott like circulated nudes of one of them around the school, destroyed her reputation. Her dad had to like come in and talk to the principal and got shown the nudes. These are the photos that are circulating of your daughter. And then at the end of the film, she crushes their car and is like, take that for not being friends with me anymore. It's like, no, you're like, you know, you're so the villain.
I say this with love. I actually think you have told this story five times on the podcast.
I have, but it's
useful. It's useful.
Yeah, because we explicitly brought it up. I'm not expecting people to have seen the Power Rangers movie from 2017, I think. But it's one of those kind of characters, and the plot begins because Dina essentially tries to kill Sam when they're following Sam and her new boyfriend driving behind the Shadyside bus, and they like open up the back of the bus and go to like throw, you know, at the end of football games, I guess this is the thing in the States, not here, and they have that big jug of like
Gatorade.
I was going to say Gatorade, but I presume it's not Gatorade. I don't know. Of orange sports drink that they like tip over the coach. They have that. And they go to like splash it over the car. And then Dina gets a nosebleed and then just drops the thing, causing a massive car accident. Then like, again, this whole time we're supposed to feel sorry for her. And I just did not buy into their relationship. I felt kind of sorry for Sam, but also one of my biggest gripe with the film that like really, really got to me as the week went on. And it was one of those things I thought, oh, I've quite liked the film up until this point, but I don't know how I feel about that. I'm like, this is one of those classic, you have made the wrong narrative decision. This isn't me having a gripe with the film. This is you. This is objectively the wrong thing to do. So we have the main cast of five. So you've got Dina, her little brother, who's kind of the one who knows the history of Shadyside. So he knows all about the curse. You have Sam, Dina's girlfriend. And then you have...
Or ex-girlfriend. Soon to become girlfriend.
And then you have Kate, who and who's the other one? Simon? Yeah. And so the,
don't ask me.
and so Kate, not Kate that I work with, Kate is like sells prescription pills, and like she's one of the kind, she has like quite a nice character arc, and Dina's little brother is in love with her, and they have like a few little moments, and then Simon's just there around. Now, when they go to the mall at the end to confront the killer, so they do it by like, because they're attracted to Sam's blood. So they like need to sacrifice. They essentially want to kill Sam. And then revive her. So they want to kill her in a way that they can revive her. And in doing this, everyone's like, all right, we'll hold off all the killers while you kill Sam. The way they're going to do that is by ODing her and then, giving her an EpiPen. And then Kate and Simon die in like quite gory ways. Simon takes an axe to the head, and Kate gets shoved through like a bread slicer.
Yeah.
And it's like, and then they go, well, fuck, because they spill all the pills. And then they go, well, I'm just going to have to drown Sam. And it's like, A, you could have done that first. But now, like, because the whole point is that they don't want Sam to, like, it not to work and Sam to actually die. But it's like, now you've actually traded two lives for one.
Yeah.
And that's a net loss. And it's done, and they're done in like, ha, fuck yeah, kind of kills. But it's like, these are two these are the two characters I've been invested in. And the little brother, like, can't stand Sam and Dina, but, like, you killed two of the three actually interesting characters in completely undeservingly gory ways. And, like, the characters fucked up. And then when she fucking drowns Sam, she doesn't start CPR for so long. She just goes, Sam,
and
no,
she's
you
already
did.
On a bunch of drugs as well. So it's like, don't you have to deal with the drugs you've overdosed her on as well as CPR now? Richard Martin, I've never felt closer to you. I've never been more in love with you as a podcast host than right now, because when Kate got shoved through the bread slicer, I was like, fuck, I hate this. I will go one step further than what you were saying about Sam and Dina. I didn't like any of the characters, but even not like somehow I hated all the characters. But then when Dina got shoved through the bread slicer, I was like,
okay.
Kate, sorry, got shoved through the bread slicer. I was like, I don't want to watch this movie anymore. It's too far. It's such a weird thing to say, because it's not that it's a movie that, I'm so glad you brought this up, because this was the sticking point for me. I was like, that was horrible. And you're right about the net loss. Like, earlier in the film, they're like, we're going to kill Sam to end the curse. And then they're like, no, we can save her. And so they save her right at the last second. And then, as you say, two of them end up dying because of that.
So it's like, you like, just kill Sam.
Yeah, exactly. Easy. So the thing is that it's not that the movie isn't gory, right? It's not like her getting a head shoved through the bread slicer is outside the realms of what I'm expecting.
It is the goriest death in the film, to be fair.
It is, but it's not. I like, that could have happened to another character, and I wouldn't have been like, oh my god, this ruins the film.
Yeah.
It's the fact that, like, you said, like, I didn't want any of the characters to die by the end of it. It felt narratively, and because I think you can have there's a danger in complaining about character deaths, because you can just say like, well, that's the stakes, that's the game, baby. But it's like, it's the example people always bring up is when the, like, journalist
in Jurassic World,
who is it? It's like their babysitter gets fed to the plesiosaur or whatever it is.
Well, eaten by pterodactyls, and then the pterodactyl.
And it's a character who karmically did nothing wrong, and our story
except just be a bit distant.
Yeah, and our storytelling compass tells us that in movies, character deaths have to mean something. They have to be deserved or whatever. And,
well, it's not even the death, it's how gory the death is. Like, that character could die, and it's like, oh no, now they don't have a guardian, kind of thing. But it's you're supposed to revel in, like, deaths like that. I'm trying to think, like, because it's such a drawn out scene. She gets picked up, she gets passed around, and then finally the fucking sea monster comes out and eats her, and you're supposed to be like, fuck yeah, she's getting what she deserves. And it's like, the storytelling language, the filmmaking language you're using to show, to, like, in this death is supposed to elicit this response, and it's not.
Benny from The Mummy is a good example of
that
being a successful way to do it. So Kate gets shoved through the bread slicer, and I watched this. It was Flat Night when we watched this, so it was my turn to choose what we do for Flat Night. And I was like, we all kind of like horror movies, so I was like, there's this cool new pulpy horror movie out that I technically have to watch for the podcast, but I feel like we'll all enjoy it. By the time we got to the bread slicer part, I think we're all clocked out. But when she goes through the bread slicer, we were all just like, oh fuck. And it ruined, if that didn't happen, I'm not gonna say I would rate it higher than I did, but it went from being a movie I didn't like to a movie I detested, because I thought it's just such a misreading of what kind of film you're making.
But again it's that same thing we spoke about with the lesbian twist, is that it's like
The lesbian twist.
The hot new dance move. But, like, it's the kind of thing where, like, if you spoke to Lee Janiak about the, like, the Kate dying, she would be like, I knew you'd be upset about that. You know, the stakes are so high. And it's and there was a whole thing about, because it's written into the script that, like, she gets shoved through a bread slicer. And the props department did a practical mock-up of it to prove to Lee Janiak that it wouldn't work. And it did. And they were like, oh, okay, well, I guess we'll put it in the film then.
Like, I can take a character getting their head shoved through a bread slicer.
Yeah.
It's not that happening that bothers me. It's the character they choose to do it through. Someone who is halfway through a romantic subplot, a character arc where it's like, you've made me invested in a way where... And because then, okay, here we go, Lee Janiak. If you really want to justify it, show me the effects in the sequels of what
that's the thing as well.
The characters are affected by this. It's like, they don't give a shit.
They do not give a shit. It's like your friend has died in the most fucking horrific way, and they're just like, "Whoo, wee! Oh, I hope Sam doesn't stab me tonight." Mm. And it's like they just do not fucking care at all. And again, that's another thing that we've spoken about. I was listening to a podcast recently, an episode that we did.
One of our podcasts.
Yeah.
You say you were listening to a podcast, it's implied you meant our podcast.
Yeah, obviously. This is one of the worst examples of people just not fucking caring at all when their friend dies.
Oh, it's classic. It's classic horror movie in a bad way. I think it's one of the worst tropes.
And also the thing that like as well is, when you're doing a throwback to Scream as well, like, all the main characters famously survived the first Scream, apart from the villains. Miss the mark on this one. But, and I also think they probably didn't go far enough with the 90s theme.
Oh, you didn't think all the needle drops were good enough? You didn't think that was clear?
Yeah, the needle drops are a big thing in the first two and the second half of the third one.
This could be set in 2021. Like, it doesn't.
Yeah, it's not predicated. Like, if I was making these movies, I would set them around the fact that that, like, I would give them problems that could be solved by today's technology, you know?
Yeah, sure.
or like problems that can only be solved because of something that was invented in 1992. Like, it's just neon and needle drops. But yeah, the needle drops are insane. And I didn't go into, like, actually listing what they are, but a lot of people have documented that there's a bunch of anachronistic needle drops in the films of songs that came out after the year the film was set.
That's not that bad, though.
Which is like, it's like, yeah, whatever. But if you're going that hard on it and making that the identity of your film, it feels like something you would fact check.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So the bread cutter stuff was the thing I disliked. That was the, like, hatred that boiled within me after seeing this film. But overall, I didn't like it up until that point either. Like, this movie felt very much straight to DVD mid-2000s horror. The budget's low, the acting isn't very good. I thought that I remember, like, renting these kinds of movies out on DVD from United Video in, like, 2007,
like, because the Dakota Fanning cool. Robert De Niro hide and seek.
Well, that went to theaters, though. I'm thinking, if you want to go obscure, the movie this gave me flashbacks to is, I think, a 2008 film called Dance of the Dead, which we got because we were into zombies, and it was just real
bad. I went through a zombie phase as well and rented a bunch of, zombie movies like that. The most obscure one I can remember is a film called Undead. It was an Australian film, and we got it because the cover had a guy with a three-barreled shotgun. And then it's this Australian film, and then it ends with, like, the zombies, like, rising up to heaven. Yeah. It's fucking weird.
Nice. So the other thing I really didn't like, so there are three three types of dislike I have for this movie. I have, it was just bad, like, your garden variety. It's cheap. It's not very well acted. The story's not very good. It's too long, not very funny. You have, you made an incorrect character or story decision, and it's left a horrible taste in my mouth with the bread cutter. And then there's also the third section, which is, this is an irresponsible movie because the two of the main characters are, like,
are lesbians.
No, that's not what I was gonna say. I was gonna say that they're like prescription drug dealers, right. Like elite, you know, like they're stealing drugs from the pharmacy they work at and selling them to people, and it's sort of a subplot of the film. The climax of the film is they're like, we've got to make Sam die and then revive her. How are we going to do it? Okay, 13 to 18 year old children watching this movie, here's how to manufacture a drug overdose, and here's how to bring them back so you'll be okay. Like, it gives you a step-by-step guide on which prescription drugs to use to kill yourself and bring yourself back. And even if they're not real drugs, you're still framing this in a movie where you're telling teenagers how to do this. And even if it's not real, they go, well, maybe this will work. Maybe this drug, I can put this drug in place of this drug.
Yeah, it's like, well, even if it's not those drugs, drugs are still cool.
Yeah, I was baffled. Like, it is very rare that I will make this call on a movie. It's very rare I will see something and I'll go, that was an irresponsible decision, you know, because usually I'm far too cool to make that call, you know, like violence and video games, all good. But when you're making a movie that is so, and you'll agree here, is like, it's so expressly targeted at teenagers. Then you have this very realistic conversation about how to manufacture a drug overdose. Like, it's weird, man. Like, it's not the same as, like, Breaking Bad, where it's like, well, people could make meth based off Walter White's instructions. Like, but Breaking Bad's a show for adults.
Yeah, and it's also like, meth isn't cool. Drugs are cool, except meth.
And I was just staggered by that. Like, that I think is the one thing that makes me really shocked by an 83% audience score. Is that I'm
No, that's,
I'm
a,
like,
that's a critic score. The audience score is 64.
Right, because I would have thought, like, the irresponsible nature of that is the type of thing I would think critics would hammer down on.
Yeah.
And also, it's just a shit movie, and I don't understand why people like this.
I do want to say as well, what was your... I'll say mine, and then I want to get yours. But the kind of experience of hearing about these films for the first time, because you mentioned that you heard about these on Cider Pop Show years ago. And I will say, just on the kind of development of it, it was in 1997 that the rights to the Fear Street books were first purchased with the intent of making a movie.
I do want to talk about the Fear Street books at some point.
Yeah, I've got
some
information about
them.
And then 2015, it was announced they're making a film, which was later going to be announced to be part of a series, which was going to be... So the original plan was last year they were going to release them in cinemas a month apart. And then Netflix bought them and decided to do the weekly release, which I think works better. I think these are much more Netflix films than anything else. Like, these are fucking, like, your Riverdale-ist...
It reminded me of the Scream TV show.
Yeah.
Like, it's as bad as the Scream TV show.
Lee Janiak actually directed two episodes of the Scream TV series.
There you go.
And only directed one other film.
Surprisingly good, my fucking butthole, okay? This is Scream TV quality. It's no good.
It is similar quality, although I did like the Scream TV series. Except the season we watched. I didn't like that one.
Yeah, that's the only one I've seen.
Yeah. season three. But the it's very much that Netflix straight to Netflix quality. And yeah, it's the your Riverdale audiences. And I like Slash Film is my go-to website for, like, movie news, and they posted articles, and that was how I first found out about it, was that, I mean, because I hadn't watched the Cider Pop Show about it, but it must not have been what I was on, but the Slash Film article said, like, hey, we're spotlighting this because I've seen them and they're pretty good. And it was like, these are, you know, pretty fun horror movies, the throwbacks. And it's like everything about it is lined up to be what that promised, that it's like these unique releases on Netflix and these, like, throwback horror movies. I was always like about the fact that the third one is 1666, because 94 and 78 are such clear, like, horror genres almost, but then going back to 1666 is like, it's going to be tough for me to care about this. Spoilers. It was.
What were you started this asking me a question.
Yeah,
what was question?
No, well, just like, how did you kind of find out about these, and had you heard much about it? Because also I didn't watch any trailers for these because I wanted to go in completely blind, just knowing that these were fun horror movies.
Yeah. Okay, well, so I found out about these. So, yeah, as you said, in 2017, we very briefly did a live stream news show called Soda Pop Show, where we'd drink funny flavors of soda.
Which is still available online.
Yeah, and talk about the Hollywood news. And I'd never done a Hollywood news show before, and there were a couple weeks in there where, like, there were no, like, major news stories. Mm. And they were very hard to do. And this was one of the ones I remember was... the announcement of the Fear Street trilogy going to theaters released 1 month apart. That it was like a oh shit, like this is kind of interesting. And so yeah, 2017 was when I found out about these, and then they just never came out and I completely forgot about them.
Well, they're supposed to come out, like, last year, so it's like that's about how long it takes to make three films.
Yeah, no, you're right. Yeah, but I think it's interesting because I agree that they are suited for Netflix, but I also think that does remove the entire experiment, which was when these were announced, it was at a time when, like, the blurry line between what is a film and what is a TV show was getting even more blurred. Yeah. And so it was playing with the idea of, like, the MCU basically being, like, a TV show which releases a new episode every 3 months and Netflix releasing movies all the time. And so it was an experiment to see, does this model work for theatre-based films? Sure, yeah. I don't think these are theatre-quality films. I think if these did come out, it would be less like this groundbreaking new release model and more like when, like, a Doctor Who Christmas special is playing for one night only at a local cinema. Like, that's more what they would feel like, I think. So, yeah, I was always sort of peripherally interested. And
also being a franchise podcast as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's kind of like you see interviews with the directors and producers and whatnot, and they talk about how it's an attempt to see if the binge model will work with films. And so they're like, okay, we decided 1 week apart because that's enough to keep momentum was the word I was looking for. To keep the momentum without cannibalizing each film's release. And I think it's like it worked, like, ostensibly what they were going for worked regardless of the quality of the films. People are talking about these films, and it's easy to, like, you've got a week to be like, yeah, did you see that? Oh yeah, no, check it out. And then it's not like, oh, I'll, you know, have to wait a year or even a month for it. But yeah, on the film as well, and the kind of the release schedule, Lee Janiak said that the biggest thing I was thinking was about how do you keep an audience from feeling like they're satisfied with each movie but still wanting to learn more in a way that they don't feel like it's a trick. There was a lot of time thinking about the ends of movie one and two. I didn't want it to feel like you just watched this next movie because you didn't get any answers. Now, I think they accomplished that until, like, the last minute of the film. Like, it is very much like, and that's what, yeah, I wasn't so much a fan of that. And that was one of the things that started my downfall of opinion of the film, because as the film ended, I was like, I mean, you know, the Kate's death notwithstanding, I had a reasonably good time, I think. And then it's just like Sam stabs Dina, which has no impact on the plot in the next film.
How many? There are hundreds. There's like 7 to 10 characters in this trilogy who get stabbed in the gut and they're fine. Anyway, we'll talk about that, I think, later on. But
Well, we're going to be talking about this a lot longer than I think I thought we would, which is good. It's good content.
I also want to say that on the release model, I'm going to say something potentially controversial here. Because you, when you said we should do the Fear Street trilogy for Film Franchise Four Nights, you were like, I know I'm the one that usually wants to do Film Franchise Roulette. I like doing Franchise Roulette as well, but you always seem so miserable whenever we can't do it. and it was like just after we'd done The Mummy, so we haven't done Franchise Roulette for months, right? And you were like, I really want to watch this franchise. And it's like, okay, yeah, man, sure. We have a lot of arguments in the Discord. It's a recurring argument over what counts as a franchise. If you're wondering the answer to this question, whatever me and Richard thinks is a franchise is usually what counts as a franchise. Other people have the most fucked up,
The thing that adds some verisimilitude to our argument is that we always agree with each other as well.
Yeah.
Don't always agree necessarily on how to break things up, but whether or not something counts as a franchise, I don't think we've ever majorly disagreed on.
Now, I will happily consider Fear Street a franchise.
Yeah.
But it's a film franchise using exclusively TV show model language. And what's that called? It's called a miniseries. This is a miniseries.
Yes. Yeah. Well, and also,
this isn't a film franchise.
The fact that... Well, yeah, I mean, like, if these had been released theatrically, there'd be no question about it. But I did think that, and I was like, oh, God, people are going to drag us over the coals for this one. But, like, they are films, though.
But like, even, like, a miniseries have hour and a half long.
Yeah, exactly. You look at something like Sherlock.
Sherlock's a great example. Are the Sherlock seasons a miniseries? Or are they a film franchise? I don't know. I just feel like this is... Yeah, this feels borderline out of our wheelhouse because of how much of a TV show it felt like. Especially the last film, which feels like way more
two
like an episode
of a television show.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, do you have much more to say about the first film?
Only that to remind people that at the end, Dina gets stabbed in the stomach. Oh, no. Do you know what happens when you get stabbed in the stomach in real life?
Not much.
Like your stomach acid escapes your stomach and starts like tearing up the rest of your body. You fucking die horribly when you get stabbed in the stomach in real life.
But it does take a long time to die from stomach wounds.
How long?
If you've seen Reservoir Dogs, that's how Tim Roth's character survives so long, because it's while being one of the most painful places to get shot, it does take the longest to bleed out.
But he's also incapacitated, right?
Oh,
he's
not running around. It's not a pleasant experience.
He's not running around malls happily strategizing on how to kill these undead monsters.
They just completely forget, eh?
They completely forget that she got stabbed in the stomach. And the worst part is like, okay, don't write that she gets stabbed in the stomach then. I don't need her to be stabbed in the stomach. Mm. She could be, you know, knocked over the back of the head or something. Like, it's so strange that it's like, that's the decision. She gets stabbed in the stomach, and she's the rest of the time we see her throughout the trilogy is like directly following this stabbing. Mm. Anyway. Sorry.
No, it's quite all right. All right, I've got some other little bits and pieces here we could do, like some randomly placed useless statistics.
Oh!
So this is, and I fucking deliberately, listen to my wording here, this is the 28th episode of Film Franchise Fortnights, where all the films discussed are directed by the same person. Now, I didn't say franchise, this is like dividing up by episode. So episodes where we, even episodes where we covered like a trilogy plus one film, and if the trilogy was all directed by the same person, that doesn't count.
Right.
Okay. So it was so much easier to count this way. So this is actually tied for the shortest release window on for Film Franchise Fortnights. Can you guess what it's tied with?
Nymphomaniac,
get that. Part one and two. This is, I'm talking about, because Fear Street movies were shown earlier as well. So if you go like, oh no, Nymphomaniac was part one premiered here, part two premiered here. The US release of Nymphomaniac was 2 weeks apart, and so went off that. Mm. And this will be a fun game. This is our fourth franchise we've ever done where every film came out after we started the podcast.
Fuck, just tell me. I don't know.
Can you guess?
oh, God.
So that means, the first film in the franchise had to come out after, what is it, like June 6th, 2016?
Oh, I was going to say London Has Fallen, but that's not true.
No, that's just what's up.
Yeah. I can't think. It's going to just be boring silence of me trying to remember. Tell me.
Okay, so the first most recent one after that is Bad Moms. The first film came out a month after we started the podcast. Pup Star, the first film came out two months after. And Happy Death Day, where the first film came out in 2017.
Those are all franchises that are in some way were either covered differently or exist as part of a larger franchise, negating that fact. Yeah. And also, Fear Street kind of belongs in that category as well. Like, because Bad Moms we watched with Daddy's Home.
And Daddy's Home came out in 2015, the first one.
Right. And Pup Star is part of the Air Bud larger series. And Happy Death Day we watched in the Halloween episode where we did a bunch of franchises. So that's fun. And Fear Street absolutely belongs in that weird. You could add another caveat to that statistic where it's not only the fourth franchise where all the movies came out after we started the podcast, it's the fourth franchise where all the movies came out after we started the podcast, but they either were released uniquely or we covered them uniquely.
So I've got information about the books, but I'll do that between films 2 and 3. So that was the little interlude between films 1 and 2. Now we'll move on to film 2, then so on. So next up is Fear Street Part 2, 1978, which was actually the last one filmed, which is like, oh, interesting. But then that it's like, sense. There's a lot of shared, not only actors, but also like storyline in the first and third one. So it makes sense to do those two back to back.
Yeah.
What is Fear Street Part 2, 1978 about?
All right, so they take the now possessed Sam to the house of the woman who they found out had died and revived and thought she'd broken the curse, but she's called them up to tell them that's not how it works. So she goes there, and they go there, and her name is C. Berman, and she tells them about her experience, which was back in 1978 during Camp Nightwing.
Yeah, and so what happens?
She on the same street as the first.
Yeah, it's the same town. Yeah, so the important thing is that she says, "I went to this camp, and a week later, my sister was dead." And then we flash back to 1978. We meet two sisters. Cindy Berman, now Cindy does start with a C, and then Ziggy Berman, who starts with a Z. So obviously, you know.
Yeah. So the way, we haven't mentioned this yet, but the way that Sarah Fair's curse works is that there's like this underground cave where people's names get written on this plinth. Mm. And if your name is written, you become possessed. And you become an agent of fear, and the Cindy's boyfriend,
Cindy's nuts. Sorry, continue.
he gets attacked by the like local nurse, the camp nurse, and it's because she knows about this plinth and saw his name was written on it. Unfortunately, she can't kill him, and he ends up getting possessed and goes on an axe-killing spree across the camp, and it follows sort of the two sisters' separate stories where they're both trying to stop everything from happening. They slowly sort of unravel the mystery as it's going on, and then it ends with, again, all of Scooby-Doo 2 Monsters Unleashed style, all the previous possessed people coming back to life. Probably the most interesting thing about the films too, that was weirdly like under focused.
Yeah.
And
because also when all these previous ones, it's like we're told like, oh, there was the mailman back in 32 and we see him. So there's a bunch of unexplored ones that, you know.
Yeah. And it ends with the two sisters trying to bury the hand of Sarah Fair because she chopped her hand off. That's a big thing. I'm real foggy on the lore. They're trying to break the curse, essentially. Yeah. But unfortunately, they both get attacked by the monsters. They are both killed, but Sadie Sink from Stranger Things, who plays Ziggy, is brought back to life, and we're given the groundbreaking, shocking twist that C. Burnham was actually Ziggy Burnham. Berman. Because her name is actually Christina. And so the whole time, Sadie Sink was Gillian Jacobs in the
who
future.
Plays the adult C. Berman. And so this, the story of Fear Street Part 2 in 1978 is being told to Dina and her younger brother by Gillian Jacobs, playing the adult C. Berman. And when she gets to that point of the story where both sisters are lying there, Ziggy's been stabbed multiple times in the gut, and Cindy is just getting an axe to the chest over and over again. Mm-hmm. And then Ziggy gets revived, and Dina's little brother goes, "Wait, you're Ziggy?" Which means that Gillian Jacobs told this entire story in third person. She said, "And then Ziggy went off and did this. Meanwhile, Cindy was out in the woods doing this." And like, why is it a twist to the people listening to the story? It makes no sense. It's so stupid.
I agree. But also, is this a twist for me? Because Richard, I didn't know that. I thought this is one of the funniest things that's ever happened to me watching a movie with a twist. And like, of all the twists I haven't seen coming, I've never not seen a twist coming because I didn't realize what was being.
That happened
up.
To me when I read The Kite Runner in class. Right.
I was actually expecting it to be revealed that Cindy was Jillian Jacobs. Mm. I was like, that's how, like, I was misreading the movie so intensely that I thought it was going the other way. Because here's the thing. I've forgotten that her name was C. Behrman. Right? Like yeah. So I'd forgotten that the C was the crucial part. But when Gillian/Jillian, my mum's name is spelt the same way and it's pronounced Gillian. I don't know why people say Gillian
Jacobs. Gillian Jacobs pronounces her name Gillian Jacobs.
Stupid. Don't pronounce your name that way. It's Gillian. Grow up. So when she starts telling the story and the movie flashes back, it flashes back to Sadie Sink running through the forest. And so if you are not paying attention, if you forgot the character's name, you're going to believe the whole movie that's who we're talking about.
Well, okay, so what happens is, yeah. You're right.
It's the language of the filmmaking is like, now we flashback. Because I've seen this done before in Saving Private Ryan, where it is a twist that it's not the character you thought the older version was. But because it went back to Ziggy, that's why I thought, oh, they're going to reveal that it's actually Cindy is the one telling the story, which is what you're supposed to think already.
Yeah, like that was, but they, yeah, she does, she, it flashes back on the line, my sister, well, like, and it, a week later, my sister was dead. And it's like, yeah, it's still like, the this is how you do a flashback, as you show the older character and you flash to the younger one. Mm. Yeah, it's bad storytelling.
Yeah, it is. And also, like, I think another part of it was like, Cindy is already too old enough that, like, my mind isn't willing to believe she will one day look like Gillian Jacobs. Yeah. Whereas Sadie Sink, who, by the way, is the best actress in this franchise, she could feasibly grow up into Gillian
Jacobs.
It's
like, it's funny. I haven't seen Stranger Things, but everyone keeps on acting like Sadie Sink is like a name I should know.
Mm. Yeah.
Or
she's
it's
in
like,
Stranger Things.
Who is she in Stranger Things?
She's in season 2.
Oh, right.
She's a new character.
Right, yeah. Everyone's like, oh, the one played by Sadie Sink, and I'm like, I don't know. Didn't learn the character's name.
Yeah.
It's like you've done bad filmmaking.
Yeah, and so the movie ends with they dig up the hand from under the mall, the tree in the mall, the hanging tree that's now in the mall, and they go to bury it with the body, and Dina does this, and suddenly sees a trailer for the next movie in her mind.
A vision of 1666 where she is Seraphia. One thing I will say about this film, we talked about the needle drops, and again, everyone's kind of been going on about them. This one has a really fucking cool one where it flashes back to 1978 and plays The Man Who Sold the World by David Bowie. And then at the end, when it flashes to 1994 again, plays the Nirvana version. I thought that was fun.
That is fun. So what did you think of this one?
This is my favorite one. With our attachment to films like Halloween and Friday the 13th and those franchises, it was fun to see that explored. This was actually filmed at the same on the same like camp as Friday the 13th Part 6. Jason Lives.
That was fun. Yeah, I thought this was the best one. I still wouldn't say I especially liked it, but it was enough in there for me to give it the platonic ideal average score of 3 stars on Letterboxd.
Sure.
I think it benefits from being the most self-contained one as well.
Yeah, for sure.
I liked it enough. I had enough fun with it to be like, because I go into this movie with like a sour mood, right? Like I hated the first one, so I'm like, oh god, and then ended up not being too turned off by it. And there was some really cool stuff in it. There's a really cool kind of like metatextual moment where the killer gets a potato sack put over their head as a means to try and distract them, but then that becomes their like serial killer look. They're a man holding an axe with a potato sack on their head. I thought, okay, so I did some research, borderline did some research for this film. I looked up and then asked a social worker friend of mine, in which instances should you do CPR, right?
Yeah.
Because I always, as someone who's only ever seen CPR done in movies and ignored my way through a first aid course in 2012 and shouldn't have gotten a certificate, frankly. I thought that the only time you would use CPR is if someone had suffocated or had drowned or something like that. I thought that's the context in which you use CPR, right? And even then, you have to shock their heart like back to life first. And then, like, if they're already dead, you can't perform CPR on them, basically. That's
if people are dead, you can't do anything. They're dead.
Yeah. So Ziggy gets stabbed so many goddamn times in the stomach, dies on the ground, and then her like love interest runs up to her. And much like when you've just drowned a character who you also made overdose on drugs in the last movie, you should probably deal with both problems at the same time. He starts performing CPR on Ziggy. And she comes back to life from CPR after getting stabbed 100 times. And it's like, not only is it like that's not how you would bring someone back from stabbing if you could bring them back, but like you have to do chest compressions and that's going to make all the blood splurt out. Like they're going to be losing more blood if you're doing this to them. I'm going to say this, Richard. I like this movie, but seeing someone get brought back to life by CPR after being stabbed to death is maybe the dumbest thing I've ever seen in a film.
Like CPR
in terms of unintelligence.
What did your friends say?
They were like, "Yeah, that wouldn't work."
I don't know necessarily that it would work, but you are supposed to, like, I think CPR is a very valid
and thing a stab
to
wound.
Yeah,
you're just going to be losing more blood
for being unconscious. Should you perform CPR? Because it's all about, essentially, if someone's unresponsive or not breathing, like, that's what you do CPR for, is to, like, get that, and it, you know, the beat that you do it to is supposed to mimic the heartbeat kind of thing, and you're trying to kind of, like, beat their heart and breathe for them.
Yeah. I mean, okay, sure, but regardless, I'm sure I'm not the only person on the internet to be like, oh, she got stabbed, they did CPR.
Well, it's also like, yeah, the fact that, like, because if you, like, okay, let's say we're on Family Feud, you go, when should you perform CPR? The top answer would be when someone's drowned, like, just based on movies. Nothing else.
Yeah.
It's, you know, you CPR, you see working when someone's drowned. It takes Dina so fucking long to start CPR on Sam, but like stab wounds, he's like, all right, I know what'll help this.
Yeah. Which again, it's one of those things where it's like Dina doesn't have to get stabbed in the stomach at the end of part one. Something else can happen. And in the same way, why doesn't the scene take place next to the lake? Why doesn't she get strangled? Why doesn't she just get drowned? So that you can create a realistic scenario in which bringing back someone to life through CPR would work. It's so dumb. I thought it was so stupid.
Again, we have that like trading lives thing where Cindy goes, I'll hold them off so you can escape. And they both just immediately get fucking stabbed.
Yeah.
And it's like,
oh my God, also, it's so like, amateur.
I really liked Cindy. I thought Cindy was a great character. Yeah. Like, it's your typical virgin, and so that they do that whole thing of like, oh no, stop it, like, and wears the cross around her neck, doesn't swear, and is your textbook final girl, which I think is like, again, it's supposed to be more red herrings to be like, yeah, this is C. Berman because she's got all the tropes of a final girl.
So funny.
But yeah.
Bad, dumb stuff. So yeah, I don't know. It's like I'm really loving that we're both dunking on these movies. I thought that it was going to be the opposite, but I don't know. There's stuff I liked about this one, I guess. But yeah, the all the movies I felt like they have like sexual or sex scenes in them, and all three are like. I don't know. I thought they were like kind of again one of those cases of like. This is maybe a little bit too sexy for the type of the like
the sex scene where we meet Alice.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and it's like graphic, like humping on a bed.
Yeah,
and it's like
I don't
it's
even
like
a bed, it's on like a bureau,
right? But it's like the rest of the first movie and this movie didn't really like. I don't know. I'm not a prude. I don't mind sex scenes in films, but I do think you should have a good handle on like how tasteful you should be in what you're showing in those sex scenes. Because in the first and third film, they're the characters that play Dina and Sam. Both have very intimate, like nearly sex scenes. Mm. And both of those I thought were like too.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Too sexy. And what? No, two, like the one in part two, there's two in part two where you see people like having, they're filmed in exactly humping. The same way as well. It's weird. Yeah. It's like the cinematography is like the same for both scenes. They both feel like too gratuitous for the movie. And the ones in part one and three feel almost too like romantically, like too real, I think is what I'm trying to say. They feel too real for the rest of the like pulpy film we're seeing, I guess. But maybe I'm just a loser that can't take a good sex scene. That's also possible.
Yeah, that's probably it. Do you have anything else you want to say about part two?
I don't think so, which is surprising, but it's that thing where it's like, when it's good, I have less to say about it.
Well, it's just, yeah, and like you said, it's more self-contained, whereas like there's less egregious shit in the sequel one.
So,
in between parts two and three, I just want to take a quick moment here to talk about the books a little bit.
Please, because I know nothing, and I asked you during the week. I was like, I am resisting the urge to satiate the like curiosity in my brain by looking at what the deal is with the Fear Street books. I know Goosebumps. I don't really know Fear Street.
Fear Street. Like you guessed earlier, they are aimed at a slightly older audience than Goosebumps. They typically feature slightly older protagonists.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, as far as the main hook of the film series is the time period thing, right? And the release.
Mm-hmm.
So the books are more or less set when they came out, late 80s, early 90s, and it does involve it's the Shady Side, Sunnyvale, etc. And it's based around the Fear family, F-E-A-R, which is, their name was originally spelled F-I-E-R, like it is in the films. However, after being told that the family was cursed and the letters could be rearranged to spell fire, Simon Fear changed it to Fear, F-E-A-R, in the 19th century, and the curse survived. But in the books, the curse was brought about when the Good family, what is it? It's confused. I'm trying to remember which one happens in the film because it's different. It flips it in the books. Or in the films, I guess they flipped it. The Fears had two innocent, good killed for practicing witchcraft.
G-O-O-D-E.
Yeah. And so the patriarch of the Good family put a curse on the Fears for killing them.
Right. And how many books are there?
I'm so glad you asked. How many would you guess?
69.
How many would you guess?
20.
So, strap in. There are 51 Fear Street books, 4 new Fear Street books, 6 A Fear Street novels, 3 Return to Fear Street books, 13 Fear Street Super Chillers, 5 Fear Street Cheerleader books, 3 Fear Street Sagas, 3 99 Fear Street The House of Evil books, 3 Fear Street The Cataluna Chronicles, 3 Fear Street Fear Parks, 36 Ghosts of Fear Streets, which are aimed more at the Goosebumps audience, the like younger protagonists, 18 Fear Street Sagas, different to the 3 initial Fear Street Sagas, 12 Fear Street Seniors, and 3 Fear Street Knights, for a total of 163 books. Now,
holy
can
shit.
You please do me a favor? Because I was like, R.L. Stein, I know there's a lot of Goosebumps books as well, and I was curious as to how many books R.L. Stein had written. Can you please do me a favor right now? Go open up Google on your computer and type in the words How many books has R.L. Stine written?
At least 24.
That's all it says.
Why does it say that?
I don't know, it's so funny. Like, I can't find a definitive answer, but it's like, I can find lists of every book he's written, but it doesn't have like a total at the end. I couldn't bother working one out, but holy fuck, that is so funny to Google.
Yeah, well, he's nothing if not prolific. He's essentially like a child-friendly Stephen King, you know, in more ways than one. That's crazy.
At least 24 books.
That's crazy that there's so many Fear Street books. I knew there'd probably could have been a lot, but I didn't know they were so like widespread over multiple series like that.
So. And also, so the most of them actually as well are just murder mysteries.
Right.
But a few do include ghouls, witches, etc.
Interesting, because I would have thought, before you told me that, I would have thought that the lore would have been the same and that the monsters we see but aren't focused on in the films are all the subject of their own Fear Street novel. That's what I would have assumed.
Yeah.
Scooby-Doo 2 Monsters Unleashed style, of course.
Yeah, maybe they are. Like, I mean, I didn't look into the plots of all 51 books, but the first one is called The New Girl.
Right.
So there you go.
With Zooey Deschanel?
The new guy with your mate. What's his name?
What are you talking about?
What's his name? Who's the new guy in the what's his? Oh my god!
I don't even know what you're talking.
I paid
about.
Him $50 to say happy birthday to you.
Oh, DJ Qualls.
Yeah, DJ Qualls. I was just like, I couldn't get KJ App out of my head. Talking about Riverdale.
Very few of us can.
All right, so Fear Street Part 3, 1666. What's this one about?
All right, so this one flashes back to 1666, where the actress who played Dina is now playing Sarah Fair, because it's like she's having this vision.
Having a vision, yeah.
Yep, she lives in this little town, this little pilgrim town called Union. And there's
the aptly named Union before it was split into Sunnyvale and Shadyside when they were united.
Nice. And there's sort of some creepy goings on. And this version, this Sarah Fair is in love with Hannah Miller, who is played by the same actress who played Sam. They caught kissing, which is an abomination, according to the characters, not according to me. And so when a bunch of demonic shit starts happening, they are labeled as witches for, you know, bringing the devil to Union. But what it actually turns out to be is that a guy whose surname is Goods, G-O-O-D-E, who you think is an ally in this film and is actually represented by a ancestor in the first and second film named Nick Good, who plays main character.
Who's the cop, yeah.
Yeah. It turns out that he actually fed up with the lack of fortune he has, made a deal with the devil, and it's actually been him that brought the devil to Union. But he has a fight with Sarah Fair and gets her hanged, and she's like, I will curse this town, yada, yada, yada. And then this 54-minute movie finishes. And then
if you're reading along with the Wikipedia plot summary, it just ends there.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, that's not true, because then we get about another 54 minutes of Fear Street Part 1994 Part 2. Yeah. So it's Fear Street Part 1, 1994 Part 2.
It comes up with a title on screen, cuts to black, comes up with that title, and then it continues. Yeah.
Yep, where the characters from the first film now aware that Sheriff Good, who's been sort of helping them up until this point,
is more like Sheriff Bad.
Yeah, and they write good as evil. They say the line good as evil, and when that happened, I was like, oh my god, this is R.L. Stine, and I didn't see this coming. Like, of course, like, Good is such an uncommon surname that I should have seen this coming, because it's R.L. Stine and he loves doing shit like that. He probably came up with the sentence "good is evil" first and then wrote 160 books about it.
This is, I tell you what, actually, this is my first exposure to anything R.L. Stine.
Really?
I've never read a Goosebumps book.
I read,
book.
Maybe
never,
it I've, was a Fear Street. I think I've read a Fear Street book.
What was it called?
I remember it wasn't a Goosebumps, but it was an R.L. Stine book. It was about imps. Something about imps. Is that a book?
I don't know, probably.
Look up R.L. Stine. Imp book.
Something about imps.
Scare School. It wasn't Fair Street, idiot. It was Scare Scroll School. Of course it was. It was his other series. And that was about imps. There was an imp terrorizing a school. And the big twist at the end is that all the characters who have imp hidden in their name were imps. Like, one of the main characters is called Simpson, and one of the characters is called Mr. Kimple, you know, and so, like, it turned out everyone was secretly an imp. So he does shit like that. So Good as Evil feels like textbook R.L. Stine. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so they all team up to take down Sheriff Good while the monsters are still attacking. The monsters that are still powered by Sarah Fair, meaning she was a witch. She was the bad guy.
Yeah.
It's like a twist. She was actually innocent, but it's like, okay, but
that's
she's still...
That's the twist
still...
I was talking about. You said earlier on that you didn't know what twist I meant for the third
right,
one.
Oh, sorry, no.
Which is like...
But she's not innocent.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. You're not doing wonders for your I'm not a witch claim by cursing the town for centuries, because even if, like, she didn't do the actual curse, the one that's making everyone evil, because I think that's implied to be good, there's still this whole thing about her hand and, like, when you bleed on it. So it's like, yeah, she was a fucking witch. She deserved to die.
Well, she wasn't a witch when she died. She became a witch as she died, basically. And so it's just again, it's that bad storytelling. It's like, where it's like the twist should be Fear is entirely innocent, like 100% innocent, and it's actually the Good family that have been
evil,
like perpetuating this curse. But it's not. They're both kind of evil. So they all go to the mall and they fight all the monsters again, Scooby-Doo 2 Monsters Unleashed style. It's very unclear, but I think Dina, like, touches the beating heart in the underground in the center of the mall, which gives her the power to kill Good. And
no, she makes Good touch it.
Right. Okay. Anyway, it ends the curse on Shadyside and... the mayor of Sunnyvale, who's played, or who's a good family member as well, gets hit by a truck or something. And it's like, the curse is over.
Now Sunnyvale sucks.
Yeah.
Did
you find
this
confusing? I thought it was confusing. I wasn't as like...
I watched this with two people who hadn't seen the first two as well. So.
I watched it with one person who hadn't seen the first two. I thought that this, I rated this like slightly higher than the first film, only because the first film like offended me, whereas one was just like kind of like, I actually quite liked the final maybe 30 minutes or a section during the fight where they're all strategizing how to kill the monsters. I kind of liked that, but unfortunately by that point I'm so over what I'm watching, because the 1666 stuff is not subversive enough to be interesting.
Like, fucking everyone was like, oh, how are they gonna do needle drops in 1666? And it's like, and like, they should have just done them, just fucking go nuts with them, do needle drops from the 60s, like that, like it, give me fucking anachronistic fun shit like that.
An anachronistic film, which feels like it's betraying the tone of the first two
parts. Also, like, it's the same kind of thing. Like, I just don't fucking give a shit about like periods like that. Like, you've got this massive hurdle to overcome if you're trying to make me care about some fucking coven bullshit. and then it didn't do enough. Like a Knight's Tale does. Like, give me shit like that. Like, you know, have fun with it. It's like they decided, well, you know, the 1600s weren't fun, so this one can't be fun.
Have you seen the Vivitch?
No, I haven't.
It almost goes in the opposite way. Instead of going Knight's Tale, if Fear Street 1666 is like the center of the spectrum, the Vivitch is the other end, where it's like you can't really understand what any character means because the dialogue is so old English.
Right.
But it's kind of cool, like, because it's like, yeah, sure, it's like, yeah, a little puzzle that you're working at yourself.
Yeah, and also just like the accents were bad. It didn't motivate everyone else being played by her friends as well.
So that's exactly what I want to talk about. So the accents, first of all, the accents are so bad. They're trying to, some of them are. The people who are clearly like trained actors who were hired for this movie specifically do a great sort of early American Irish kind of, there is a curse upon this town kind of thing. Yeah,
the McFly,
but like,
family.
Yeah, yeah. But the characters from Dina is playing Sarah Fair. And you also see Sadie Sink at one point in the start playing one of the villagers and Cindy. And I was like, cool. So it's the cast of the first two movies combined. It's not. Sadie Sink shows up very briefly for some reason in this and then disappears.
Yeah, and they managed to get Sadie Sink for it, like that.
I'm noting that because I just thought she gave the best performance in the trilogy, so it's like, make her Sarah Fair, you know. Like, so I thought that it's so weird because you could have done it so that each film has a different main cast, because there is already an established actress you see in flashbacks playing Sarah Fair. And so you could have done it.
Although the flashbacks we've seen up until now were Dina.
No, they weren't.
Yeah, they were. It's real weird. Like, so Sam sees visions of Sarah Fair in the first film, and it looks exactly like her girlfriend, and she doesn't put two and two together.
Are you sure? I remember it not being that. I remember it being the actress we see.
I think you see both, maybe, but you do definitely see Dina as Sarah Fair in the first film as well.
Well, regardless, you've got two choices. You make it so that Dina goes back in time, and that she's seeing the vision, and you reuse the cast in an old-timey setting. And guess what you get to do then? You get to make them all do American accents, because narratively, I can believe that the style you're going for is, because we're seeing the same characters, I'm going to ignore the fact that they're not speaking with the right accents. Sure. Right? So that's why you do that. Or you go for the original actress who plays Sarah Fair, who can do a pretty good old American accent.
It's probably Irish, yeah.
Yeah. And she's great. I would have much rather seen that movie where it's Sarah Fair played by that actress doing that, because it feels like the reason for doing it the way they did is lost when they're all doing accents. And the kid who plays her little brother in 1994 is in 1666, and boy do they do that actor dirty by making him do this accent. My dude, I'm so sorry that the filmmakers did this to you, because he cannot pull it off, and it's very embarrassing. So that's all a thing. But then also the fact that it's split up into essentially two movies I thought was disappointing as well. Because overall, I would say I am much more... I realized this... Well, this helped me realize something that I'd not realized I think about franchises before, which is crazy, 5 years in to suddenly sort of formulate this thought, is I prefer standalone sequels to story sequels.
Sure.
I always have, and I've never sort of realized it. I like, it's the thing with like how Pirates of the Caribbean 2 and 3 are connected and how that always disappointed me. And I've just sort of realized through Fear Street that like I'd be way more interested in watching these isolated movies
even if they were like in reverse order, like, and say it was like, say we saw the 30s and then the 70s and then the last one was the 90s, and that was like the, oh my god, we're bringing back all these people and the curse has been following us, and now we do the big team-up film where the killers all come back and shit.
Yeah, yeah, I don't know. I didn't like that 78 was being told to us by Ziggy. And I didn't like that this was a flashback. I think I'd just be more interested in seeing a consistent lore being represented across different time eras and just being self-contained things. Because I like Indiana Jones, how like you can watch them out of order. I think that's cool. I think a lot of franchises are so obsessed with being story consistent when, like, Pirates of the Caribbean, great example, should have just been you can basically watch them out of order. Like, characters meet in certain films, but outside of those interactions, they can be watched out of order. Because talking about titles, which we can do now or later, depending on when you want to talk about them, if we talk about titles along this podcast, I really like Fear Street 1994, Fear Street 1978, Fear Street 1666. They are ruined by having part one, part two, part three in them. But also, you can't, because otherwise people would watch them out of order, and they need to be watched in order. That's the problem. And so I think, yeah, you're losing something there as
well.
What
do you think of Fear Street part one, 1994, part two?
Yeah, bad, stupid. But also, I think Fear Street's kind of a weird title anyway, because
it's a weird title. It's a cool title, but for these franchises, for this,
I would have called it the Shady Side Killers, because they refer to, that's like the nickname they give. Yeah, and then it's
Shady Side.
Shady Side 1994, Shady Side. Yeah, that's way better. Like,
or like Welcome to Shady Side.
Yeah. Yeah, with the year after it, that's great. Like, that works, you know?
Welcome to Shadyside population, and it gets bigger.
Because it's not even like it's set on a street that's called Fear Street or anything like that.
Yeah, Fear Street is a big part of the books, and we see the street sign once in the third film, but it's, like, so not important to it.
Yeah.
So when it cuts to black, the 1666 stuff had dragged on like fucking nobody's business, and then it cuts to black and it says Fear Street 1994 part two. I was kind of like, I was actually thought they were going to say coming next week, and I would have been like, fuck, that's kind of cool. It fucks up my podcast, but yeah, I was actually kind of like, oh shit, and then I was like, oh, it's 45 minutes to go.
I mean, it does end on a cliffhanger, opening the door for more sequels, I guess, in the future, where the Book of the Dead is stolen. Our third franchise to feature a Book of the Dead after Evil Dead and The Mummy. Yeah, I don't know, man. I think, as I said at the start of the episode, like, great in concept, great in premise, very interested in the premise of this franchise. I think this is pretty bad overall. Like, it's pretty negative for me. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I still enjoyed them. I said to you last night that this is the worst franchise where I like every film.
Which I think is crucial, because I think that the reason for that is because it's about things we like. It's they're bad movies about something we really want to see in a good movie.
Yeah.
And I think that has influenced everyone's reviews. I think everyone's going like, these are actually real fun, pulpy throwback horrors. And it's like, they're not. But they're trying to be, and we so desperately want that we're like, yeah, they're pretty good. You know, it's the whole thing of like seeing, the Rise of Skywalker, how it's like they think you seeing Ewoks will translate to you enjoying the movie, and it's like it's essentially fan service, but for a genre instead of a specific IP. You know,
yeah. So that is the Fear Street trilogy. Did I have any other notes? No.
Wow.
So we can move on to the segments then, I guess.
The segments!
Anything else you want to say? We've wrapped up the franchise as a whole, haven't we?
I think so. I don't think they're very good, and I think, I don't know why people like these.
I get why people like them, I do. People like Riverdale, man. Like. Okay, so our first segment is continue the franchise, and as you mentioned, it does kind of leave the door open for sequels. On the potential future part of the Wikipedia page, it says director Lee Janiak expressed interest in expanding the film series beyond the trilogy and movies. She had stated to be interested in adapting a slasher film that takes place during the 50s and centers around Harry Rooker / the Milkman. Cast members similarly expressed interest in returning.
Okay. I mean, it does almost feel like this would be better suited just to a TV show where you can do that. Like, you could probably pretty easily cut, but even just cut down the 2 hours to 55 minutes and make a TV show, you know?
Anyway, what is your continue the franchise?
Fear Street 2020 and it's set during the pandemic. Nice. And that's the fear. Mm. I don't know. I think that this feels like a very easy continue the franchise, and for that reason I didn't try very hard to do it. Really my continue the franchise is take this format of different era set horror movies and make better movies out of them. Mm. That's my continue the franchise. What's yours?
Yeah, I was just going to try and think of, it's apparently, Fear Street, 1666. So the first two were obviously influenced by Scream and Friday the 13th. Third one was The New World, Terrence Malick film.
Hmm.
And there you go. Yeah, I just trying to think, because, yeah, it does obviously lend itself to just telling us all the stories, the other ones you've seen. I was trying to think of, like, could you do Fear Street 1932 and it's about mummies?
Mm.
But I did, reading about the thing, it's like that it's like they involve ghouls and other like more supernatural. I'm like, yeah, give me a Fear Street, but so you have Fear Street 1932, Fear Street 1960s or 1970s, and Fear Street 1999, and they're mummies,
right.
and they're influenced by the Universal Mummy movie, the Hammer Mummy movie, and the Brenda Fraser Mummy movie.
Wow. And then do you do like
Terra
Lane, which is the Scorpion King?
Yeah.
Like the side street from Fear Street, Terra Lane.
Yeah.
Interesting. Nice.
Yeah, so that's, yeah, who would have thought my continue the franchise would be more mummy movies?
It's because now they're all you can think about it.
Yeah.
It is the Yugi to your Kyber. You're like, it's actually all I ever actually wanted.
Yeah. All right, now it's time to rank this franchise. Oh my god, that's next week. Anyway, well, fuck, where is it? Film franchise covered.
I've got it.
FFF ranking. My god, we've got so many fucking lists. Edit or delete this list. Delete. All right. Fear Street. I'm adding it to the list.
Okay, part so one, this is over fun. On letterboxd.com/ColePopshire if you want to follow us. Check out our lists. We've got a list called FFF Ranking where we've ranked every franchise we've ever watched. How many is it these days?
132.
132. So I guess the question is, where does this land in... that so it's 132 including Fear Street, but where do we put Fear Street? What do you think
Are you thinking below the Nymphomaniac Constant?
Yes, I am. I'm sorry. I'm thinking pretty far below. I'm looking at them now and I'm settling around, or let me check. I've gone too low. I've forgotten how bad some of these franchises are. And I keep scrolling past them, be like, yeah, fucking. And now I'm like in above 100. So let's go. I think maybe between Live and Let Die and Twilight, back at 62. That's what I'm thinking. Yeah. I think I'd rather watch these than the Roger Moore Bond movies, but Twilight, in a way, is almost a better execution of a very similar kind of style of film.
Okay, so 62 it is.
And there we go.
All right, have you got Patreon open as well?
I can make it so.
I'm getting up now. If you want to tell people where they can find the show while I pull up our next franchise.
Well, if you enjoyed this, everybody, you can... You can like us on all the different social medias. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube. We've got two YouTube channels. One of them is called Cult Popshire, where we do video essays, and one of them is called Cult Popshire Again, which is where you may be listening to this episode. It's where we post the podcast and things like that. We also have a Discord server, which you should absolutely join. There is a link to that in the show notes. Come and talk to us about why we're wrong about Fear Street. Genuinely would, and without judgment, would love to hear what the virtues of these movies are, because I thought they were completely unlikable. We also have a Patreon, patreon.com/cultpopshit, if you want to support us financially. You get some perks, you get extra podcasts, you get 2 extra podcasts a month. You can join our movie club where we'll discuss a film over a Zoom call with you. You can give us something to talk about in the post-credit scene at the end of each episode. There's a whole bunch of stuff on there, and it's really fun. And we recently lost a couple of patrons, so you could make this sad little boy's day a lot better by joining us on Patreon.
Alrighty, so the next franchise we're going to be covering, what was initially quite like a hotly contested race, and then one just...
This is on Patreon, by the way.
On Patreon, yeah.
You get to vote for every second franchise we cover, and this is this week's vote.
So, a comment from Tim Tarbor, which says, "It won't win this late into submission, but I just remembered I wanted to toss Jumanji plus Zathura onto the pile, and that has won." So, in 2 weeks' time, we're going to be covering Jumanji, the Robin Williams film, Zathura, and the 2 new films in the Jumanji canon. Some debate as to why we're covering Zathura. I'm sure we'll discuss it next week, but we will be covering Zathura.
Very cool. Okay, that'll be next week if you want to check that out. And if you want to tell us which films we should watch, get on the Patreon. Tell us, you can, like... The united powers of the Patreon and the Discord has made choosing the next franchise a very interesting and fun sort of game each month, because it can get very heated. And I've seen films, I've resigned myself to watching a certain franchise only to see another franchise swoop in and overtake it. It's very exciting. It's gotten almost as good as franchise roulette, I think.
I don't know. I like the immediacy of franchise roulette. You know,
right?
Jumanji we've known for a fucking week and a half.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. But let us know what you thought of Fear Street, and stay tuned for when this music ends for the post credit scene.
Yeah.
All right, everybody, welcome along to the post-credits scene. This is a segment at the end of each episode where if you donate $5 or more over at patreon.com/coldpopshit, you get to give us something to talk about in this, the post-credits scene. And Richard, lay it on me, buddy. What is the post-credits scene for this episode? Who's it from?
All right, so this comes to us from Joe Rundle.
Hey, Joe.
What is the franchise you had the biggest turnaround on? Was there one where you thought you would hate before and ended up loving, or vice versa? I've got a fucking answer for you. Fear Street.
Yeah,
over the course of this podcast.
I definitely think, like, we've talked a little bit before, things like I was not expecting to like the Scream series.
Scream's
so
the classic
much.
Example, but it's like I was expecting to probably like them, but not as much as I did.
Yeah. I didn't think I would enjoy Fright Night 2011 as much as I enjoyed it.
I didn't think I'd enjoy any of Fright Night. They're fucking sick.
Yeah. What's some other ones? Oh, I thought it was real interesting when we rewatched the Freddy vs. Jason movies, and Friday the 13th fared a lot better the second time watching it than the first time. Things like that where my opinion on movies change. I think it happens less with franchises specifically and more like with individual movies. Like, I think a lot of movies that when I was 12 years old I thought were real cool, I now look back on and I'm like, well, those were bad movies. Butterfly Effect's a great example. Another example is The Number 23, the Jim Carrey, what's his name? Schumacher.
Yeah, Joel Schumacher.
Joel Schumacher movie. The Number 23, thought that was awesome when I saw it when I was like 16, and now
still
I think
is.
It's pretty bad.
Dude. Holds up.
I love shit like that. I love when it's like, I love being able to tell you've outgrown a movie. It's a cool feeling because it's like, wow, I can track my taste developing here. I think like things like, I tried to watch The Sopranos when I was 18 and couldn't get into it. And now I'm like, maybe I'd like it if I watched it now, you know, can more easily get into more mature content now.
I like how your example, though, is like, yeah, I didn't like this thing, but I don't know, maybe I would now. Look how much I've grown.
Well, I can't think of a specific franchise where I was like, I am going to hate this and ended up not hating it. Do you have any that are that extreme like that?
No, I can't think of anything.
Let me check. Let me look at the ranking. Yeah, not really. Oh, I thought I would dislike the Terminator sequels a lot more than I did.
I thought I would like any of James Bond more than I did.
Okay, no, fair enough. That's a good answer.
One that as well, I guess that I was like, these will be good, but was blown away by was the Three Colors trilogy.
Because
that's like, oh, obviously they're gonna be like good, but not really. Like them, but they're great.
Richard, looking at our franchise ranking now, and I think someone else has pointed this out before, the Scary Movie series is very high.
What's going
on there?
Where is it?
It's at 40. It's above Gremlins.
Michael
so
Swain,
I guess that's
out.
The answer, right?
Well, Scary Movie's just, we were just in the right demographic.
Nostalgia win. It's a win for nostalgia.
All right, anyway, this has been Fear Street.
See ya.
This has been the post-credit scene, to be more specific.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.